Many counted us out. They said we couldn't do it. Now, millions of listeners later, we're the hottest independent network in the world. Bashani Radio app. Download free in the App Store for iPhone and Android. Or listen online at BashaniRadio.com. You suckers. Kaboom! Kaboom in your face.
I've just discovered that I may have a son here in this land.
How much child support is she getting from?
The king pays no child support.
No child support for 30 years and you came back? You was a dummy!
Hello, I am Hakim Jaffer, king of Zamunda. You are the heir to the throne.
Yes, my father.
He's supposed to be like the prince of Wakanda.
Wakanda is a fictional place.
Not to everybody.
Zamunda is a very real nation.
I don't need no handout.
Wait a minute.
Hey, I'm gonna pack.
Okay, baby.
Presenting King Akeem's son from America.
And my mom's.
And his mom's.
Children, this is your brother.
Hey, Quang. I'm sorry I slept with your man.
This happened before we even met.
It's not like you're the first man I've ever been with.
What did you just say about the other man?
Coming to America, now it's coming to me.
You're listening to The Spectrum with Bob Ivory and Ivory Coast Media Production.
Thank you once again for tuning in to The Spectrum with Bob Ivory. It is March, Women's History Month, and we're going to hear from a Detroit living legend, Judge Leonya Lloyd. We had her on before a few months ago and didn't get to hear all of it, so we're going to roll back the wheels of time and hear some more wisdom from Judge Leonya Lloyd. Please stay tuned. And once again, thank you for listening. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Spectrum with Bob Ivory. Have an ultra super special guest with us today in the person of Judge Leonya Lloyd. Let me give you some information about her. Leonya Lloyd is a public speaker and author whose career as a judge, lawyer, and teacher has spanned decades serving the citizens of Detroit. Having sat on the 36th District Court for more than 20 years, Judge Lloyd has lived a life with many stories to tell, which are captured in her new memoir, Your Honor, Your Honor, A Journey Through Grief and Restorative Justice. Her award-winning justice programs for drug and prostitution offenders have been featured on the National Geographic Channel, A&E Network, and in the Detroit Free Press. She is a product of Detroit Public Schools and received her bachelor's and juris doctorate degrees from Wayne State University. Before becoming a judge, she was a partner in the law firm Lloyd and Lloyd, which she shared with her late sister, Leona. They were featured in Ebony, Jet, People Magazine, along with the Detroit Free Press and the Detroit News. Both she and her sister would go on to be elected to serve on the 36th District Court and be the country's first twin judges to sit on the same district court bench at the same time. They were affectionately dubbed Twins for Justice. In her spare time, Judge Lloyd enjoys going to concerts, upscale restaurants, and traveling. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Leonya Lloyd. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure and a delight. And also, I just salute your work in helping offenders and those that worked in prostitution find better lives. I think that's absolutely outstanding.
Yes, yes, yes. And I enjoyed doing that. I definitely enjoyed doing that.
All right, let's talk about your memoir. Let's talk about your book a little bit. Why is it so important? Why was it so important for you to write this particular book?
Well, I wanted to get across to my readers the message that they can never, never give up on their dreams. Mm. Too many times, I saw people in my courtrooms who had given up a long time ago, and that was just not acceptable to me. Okay, that wasn't acceptable. Mm. And my job was to reignite in them a flame so that they could go after something that they wanted to achieve.
Sure.
And, you know, I've had them for 2 years, so by the time those 2 years were over and we saw people accomplishing something they thought they had never, ever would do, they gave up, and it showed them that they gave up too soon.
Mm.
And so my whole thing was to Leona and I had talked about this, and she was one of the reasons I did this book, because we both wanted people to understand that you have to dream, and even if you dream that impossible dream, understand you can make it possible. You just can't quit.
Mm.
You just can't quit. And it that's the main thing. You cannot quit. I don't care what happens. I don't care the fact that, you know, things crumble around you no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
You have to pick up the pieces. You can have failures, learn from them, keep moving, and keep going. This is why it was important for me to write this book. This was a message we always wanted to push because we had been through so many things in our life that would normally put people back.
Sure,
it would have been easy for us, you know, to stop. And, you know, particularly when my mother got sick and how, you know, she made it difficult for us to study in college.
Right.
And to say, well, forget this, let me go get a job, and I move, and I just make some money and get an apartment.
Okay.
And forget the dream about going to school. Forget that.
Mm.
I got to get away from here because my mother's not acting right.
Wow.
That was not possible to me and Leona. Leona and I said, this was our dream. My mother had brainwashed us since we were little to go to college.
Wow.
And because she had those problems with the nervous breakdown, with the subarachnoid hemorrhages and all of that, we had been brainwashed thoroughly by her.
Wow.
So I looked at her one day and I said, I don't care what you do to us. She turned the lights off so we couldn't study.
Right.
I said, I don't care what you do. I said, but we are going to stay in school. I said, you have made that something for us to believe in, and it's too late for you to take it back now.
Wow.
We said, you did a real good job at brainwashing. I said, and we're not quitting. I looked at my mother and said, we're not quitting. She could turn the lights off. She could do whatever she wanted to do. But it was, you know, we just had to then regroup and you replan.
Wow.
And our thing was, we're going to have to move on to campus because next mama's going to take the car. And then we won't be able to drive to school. How are we going to get there? How are we going to lug all these books on a bus? And so then we went and we started interviewing for jobs on campus. We got that. We then went into the dorm and got the applications and January the next year, we made the move.
Wow.
It's like you have the dream.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to make sure it happens. You've got to make sure you take the steps. And you're going to hit potholes and you're going to hit all these negative things. Deal with it and keep moving. Keep it moving. And that's the main purpose of this book and what we both wanted to get across. And we both planned to write it together, but of course she passed.
Sure. Well, that had to be some pretty extraordinary circumstances early on in your life. So, I mean, that's a lesson in itself. I mean, how were you at that particular time when you were dealing with the issues with your mother?
We were in high school. Everything to us was going along pretty good.
Okay.
We were chosen to be the high school commencement speakers, and we were the first Black ones at Mumford to do this. My mother had been a valedictorian, so she had spoken for her class in high school as well as her nursing school.
Okay.
So she was helping us with the speeches, and she was being the mother that we knew, the mother that loved us and you know, nurtured us, et cetera.
Right.
But a few weeks before we were to actually, you know, get up there at our commencement, graduation, my mother had a nervous breakdown.
Wow.
And totally became someone we didn't know. And we were there at the hospital, the psych ward, and with my father, and we're like, 16.
We turned
17 in August that year, but we were 16. And we knew she wasn't acting right. She was seeing Jesus on the TV screen, and Jesus wasn't there.
Wow.
And when you don't know what that is, and you're a teenager, and my mother, we would sit and watch TV with her all the time. We did stuff with my mother all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so when she said, "You see Jesus there?" I said, "Huh?" And she said, right there. I said, "Well, Mama, what are you looking at?" I said, and I named who was on the screen. And I laughed, mm-hmm. because me and my sister said, "Larry, Jesus ain't on the screen." And so she said, "Yes, he is." I said, "No, he's not." I said, then I stopped laughing.
Wow.
And I looked at my mother, because she looked serious. And I said, "Mama, do you still see him on the screen?" And she looked at me and my sister, and then she knew that's the wrong answer to give. So she said, "No." And so that was the beginning of us realizing, when she would sit at night, and for those of us who are old enough to remember, the TV did go off at night. it didn't play all day and all
right.
night. Like
I remember that.
Right. And so,
Star Spangled Banner comes on, right.
Right. She was sitting up watching a blank screen.
Mm. Wow.
And so we would come in there and say, "Mama, what you looking at? Ain't I know?" And then she would get up and she'd go and get in the bed. Well, all of these were signs that, the delusions and things like this were going on, but we didn't know. And then when she really started acting out and, getting, really mean and nasty and hitting at my father and running out the door, no clothes on and stuff like that, he said, "I've taken your mother to the hospital." He said, "Meet me down there." And when we got there, and we're looking, and we why are we here? Why are we in this unit? And we didn't know, we didn't understand. And when the doctor, was explaining to us, he said, "She's had a nervous breakdown." And he said, "Well, what causes that?" And he said, "Depression." I said, "Depression about what?" And she said, because my mother was cheerful all the time. And he said, "Only she knows."
Wow.
And that's something that, we're going to have to put her in some counseling to see. Well, counseling back then was not like it is today.
Right.
And so her counseling consisted of, "Miss Lloyd, what are you depressed about?" And she said, "Nothing." And then that was it. You keep taking your meds. And she, back then, they had a method where they would hook you up and basically shocked you.
Electroshock therapy?
Yep.
And
she couldn't take that. She couldn't take it because she had a subarachnoid hemorrhage before. And the subarachnoid hemorrhage, we were five. And we remember the ambulance coming, to get her because they had got us out of school. And all she told us was to mind our father and to do what he said. She just didn't feel well. And they took her away in the truck. And so, she was there for several months, but she told my father, she said, "Don't let them go in my head." She said, "Because if they do, I won't come back the same." And you have to promise me. And so she remembered this, and at least she remembers telling it to us when she came out, she was much, much better. But she said, my father, he was inundated with questions, and "We need to do this. We need to bore a hole in her head. We need to get the fluid out. We need to." My father said no. And he said, "But you don't understand. She could die." He said, "No. She told me, no. She told me not to let you go in her head." And they said, "Well, if she does live, she'll probably be blind." And they had a whole list of negatives for my father.
Right.
And he said, "I understand." He said no. He wouldn't pray in the chapel. And the thing is that she didn't die. Every day he came in there, when the doctors came, they saw she hadn't died, but she was blind. She couldn't see. And this is when she first opened her eyes. It took a while before she even opened her eyes back up. And then when she when she could see my father, she just said, you know, who are you? And he said, I'm your husband. She said, I'm married. And he said, yes, and you have two little twin girls. They're 5 years old. And she said, I have kids. My mother didn't remember anything.
Wow.
And the sad thing I write about in the book is that she, when you have that, it's considered like a bleeding stroke.
Mm.
And if you know anybody who's had a stroke, it takes away a lot of the memory.
Wow.
It takes away a lot of your skills. People who have strokes normally can't continue doing the jobs that they have done. And they have, they're either going to be fired, or, you know, or they quit. They can't do the job.
Right.
They go through counseling today to reinvent their lives, to readjust and see what you can do. Or they get on assistance because they can't do the job they did before.
Right.
Well, my mother couldn't either. She couldn't either, but there was not anybody telling her anything or counseling her. My father didn't understand why she wouldn't go back to work after 10 years. He didn't understand. She still was a nurse. She still kept her reciprocity up.
Mm-hmm.
And she just kept saying no. She told her girlfriends who were nurses, they said, come on, Neoma, you can do this. You can do this. Just follow us and just follow us. It'll all come back to you. The fact that they said it'll all come back to you, they knew as nurses, Mama had lost some of that brain power that she had. And because they were nurses, they just didn't know the degree. And I used to hear, you know, when my parents were the other grown-ups, and I'd hear someone ask my father, are you going to stay or are you going to leave? And my father said, I'm not going anywhere. He said, this is my wife, for better or for worse.
Wow.
And he said, I have two little girls. And he said, I'm not going anywhere. Well, fast forward, when my mother had the nervous breakdown, which is connected to the depression that you get from a stroke.
Okay.
A lot of people get depression right away, within the first couple months. My mother hid hers. She just went along, tried to figure out who she was again. And I will never know to this day how much she really remembered, how much she remembered what my father told her. I don't know. Different little things would come up, and my mother medically would know certain things, you know, about illnesses. And she would scare us to death. If we caught a cold, oh, I hope you don't have pneumonia. I hope you don't have. Everything was severe
with my mother. Right.
But, you know, so this was her training coming back. But I don't think she trusted herself. And she loved being a nurse. I don't think she trusted herself back with having people in her care. So she kept that reciprocity up. And, you know, from time to time, she'd clean out her purse and look through her wallet and stuff like that. And she would show Leona and I her license to be a nurse. You see, that was something she owned. That was something that they couldn't take away. The brain was no longer the way it was supposed to be, but you couldn't take away the fact she was a nurse.
Wow.
And she would show it to us, and we were young, we were 10 years old. We're looking at this, and she would start crying. She'd start crying. And, you know, and if you ask her why she cried, she would say, oh, nothing, I just have something in my eye.
Wow.
No, it was much more than that, because she was really crying. You know, and as I wrote this book, It was really hard for me when I wrote about that, because how does a person at 30 years old lose their whole life? And you are left to live with a life that you have to create, and you don't know where to start. You don't know where to start. You don't even remember the two little girls. Even though she obviously, you know, these are my kids, I'm going to raise them.
Right.
And there were certain things that her mother had instilled in her that, of course, she remembered.
Okay.
She remembered how she was supposed to study. She remembered she had 11 brothers and sisters, all of them, 11 of them. And they all went to college.
Went
to college except two boys who ended up being morticians. And my uncle in Boston was one of the largest morticians. Just like Swanson is here, he was like that there. He had a place in Springfield as well as one in Boston. And the one he built in Springfield had trees, shrubbery trees on the roof of the building. So you can get an idea how big this thing was. But he got there after the service with two quarters in his pocket. And his older brother, who was a mortician, didn't help him. And there was such a big gap between their ages because of, you know, the time spans when each kid was born. My mother was number 10 out of 11. Wow. So he was near the end. But, you know, right. She came from a mother who owned two houses, one across the street from each other. And when I finally got down to Rock Hill, which was about maybe 4 years ago, 5 years ago, and they drove me around and they showed me where those houses used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, believe it or not, my mother's maiden name was Chisholm. They said the Chisholms owned about half of Rock Hill at one point.
Wow.
And I said, really, I saw a street with the name Chisholm. I'm learning my history.
Okay.
And my mother wouldn't go back. You know, it was a lot of sadness for her. She remembered her mother. She remembered her mother, you know, passing. She couldn't even talk about her mother without crying.
Hmm.
She couldn't, you know, they had pictures of the funeral. She would go through this picture book. They were professional pictures of the funeral that they used to do down south.
Right.
And with all of the kids circling the casket and all of that. And she would show us these things and she would cry every time she showed us these pictures. But my mother left me, and I was indicating that she had that bleeding stroke, which was that separating the hemorrhage, and she healed up from it, and she never had them go in her head. They never went in there, but it had changed her.
Wow.
And it wasn't until we were writing a paper after Mama had the nervous breakdown, and she was in the hospital, and we were writing a paper. We were just entering college, so that was our first year, and it was an assignment that we had to write about our family. And I told my father, I said, well, Daddy, you know, we're going to interview you. And he said, okay. And we want to know. And I said, everything. And so he said, okay. And as he said, he started out about him and my mother getting married. And, you know, 5 years later, we came along, and he said, and then 5 years later, you all were in school and your mother had a nervous breakdown. He said, the lady I married left that day. And he says, the mother you know is a whole new person.
Wow.
He said, she's a nice lady, but she's not the woman I married. And now you must understand, you're talking to a girl now who's 18. And I'm like looking at my father and I said, what do you mean she's not the same person? He said, the mother you know is not the woman I married. And I said, but Daddy, I said, Mama's a sweet person and she's this and she's that. And he said, I understand that. And she is very nice. He said, she's just not. And my father had tears coming down his face when he said that. He said, she's not the lady I married. And that shook my sister and I up because he had been living with a whole different personality. This personality he had been living with and we had been living with was the only one we knew. Okay, this was not the only one he knew. This was a second person to him. So when she then had the nervous breakdown, they said when depression comes from and not resolved from having a stroke, a bleeding stroke in the brain, it can lead to manic depression, which is having a nervous breakdown. And that's what it led to 10 years later. 10 years later, and then the personality changed again.
Wow.
And this time, we're witnessing it, and it's a second personality. It's a third for him, okay? And then she had another one, okay, when we were in law school, and she changed again. Each time, it was different. It was more severe. And anger was always aimed at my father. We could never understand that. And sometimes at us, if we sided with my father with something, you know, one time she slapped my glasses off my face, and I was in shock. I was in shock. I no longer lived at home. I was in school at campus, and I think I was about a junior, you know, something like that. But she slapped my glasses off my face, and my father then grabbed her and put her in the couch, you know, on the couch, and said, you can do anything to me. Don't touch my daughter. Do not touch them. Now, she knew my father was no huge, big man, but he was very strong. And if he said, don't do something, he meant don't do something. He meant that. And I talk about my father. He had a very brave spirit. And he was not fearful of anything. And I think me and my sister got a lot of that from him. We tried things and things that were challenging that we didn't know if we were prepared for, but we were not afraid to step out on faith.
Right.
And he would be, that's right, that's good. My mother, well, why you got to do that? Why do you have to do that? You're a teacher. Well, I mean, you got your certification. And you could teach for life, and they can't fire you. I said, Mom, I want to go to law school. And then she told my uncle, the mortician, she said, Napoleon, the kids told me they're going to go to law school. And he said, why? He said, I think they lost their mind.
Wow.
And again, it comes from parents who back when they were struggling. My father, who couldn't get hired, he was a black. He had the certification and the training to do that. The other positions open until he walked in there. Sorry, you just killed me. That was the story of his life. It wasn't until one of his friends, who almost let him pass for white, got him a job. He never passed for white, but because he was so fair-skinned, and he said, this is my buddy. This is my buddy. We've been buddies in the service. He's good. They hired him. And they told him about a week or two later, they said, he's everything you said he was. He said, oh, yeah. Yeah, that's good. The bottom line is that he just needed that one break. And
sure.
He didn't even ask for the help. My mother asked for him. She told the man's name was Dick Sears. She said, Dick, can you help my husband get a job? Because everywhere, you know, he said, sure, Leo, why don't you tell me? My father is not that kind of person. He's not going to ask you for help. My mother will, but not my dad. And boom, he got the job. And from that point on, so they're looking at daughters who had a position and had solidified their position, and now they want to leave it.
Let me ask you a question. Let me ask you a question, because I want to ask you a question. That had to be a traumatic experience for you to see your mother go through that, and your young girls, and even as teenagers. And you mentioned the character of your father. Is that how you were able to kind of withstand or to move beyond kind of, you know, the trauma of those experiences you had with your mother?
We clinged to him when that happened, because our father was a symbol of strength to us.
Okay.
You know, when anytime there was something wrong, you know, I can't describe how safe we felt with my father. One night, you know, we had commandeered the basement of our house. I guess you'd call it like a little teenage cave. We had a little TV down there, a little black and white TV. And,
okay.
And that was me and Leona's space. And my mother and father laughed at us. And they don't want to be in their bedrooms. They want to be down here in the basement. It's damp and everything else. But that's the kids. So we had a poodle, and the poodle kept barking. It was dark outside, barking at the window. And we couldn't see through the window, up, you know, basement windows. And so we said, why are you, be quiet, you know? And the dog kept on and kept on. And the owner grabbed him, held him, talked to the dog. Dog kept looking at the window, And I walked up to the window. I can't see out. It's dark. And I said, you know, I can't see out. I don't hear nothing. And then the dog calmed down. A little bit, my father came down 5 minutes after the dog had calmed down. Something like that, 5-10 minutes, and he said, did you hear anything at the window? And we said, no. And he said, there was a man looking through the window. That's why the dog wouldn't be quiet. That's why he wouldn't be quiet. See? And he said, he was looking at the two of you, and he must have thought the two of you were the only ones in the house. He said, and I watched this man. My father was behind these bushes that were like a natural border of the, from the patio,
sure.
from the yard to the patio.
Mm-hmm.
But he could see through these bushes. The man couldn't see him. And he said, the man took out a screwdriver out of his pocket, and he was unscrewing the guest bedroom window.
Mm.
He said, by the time he got through the third screw, my father had came through those bushes. With that, he had a switchblade. He came through those bushes, and that man saw my father coming at him with their switchblade. He took off, and he ran. They ran two blocks. The one thing about my father is very, very athletic, because he would race all the kids on the block. He said, come on. We you know how you play relay, but we would do that with the kids on the street.
Right.
My father would join us. And he said, I said, Daddy, you going to run with us? He said, uh-huh. We'll give y'all a head start. Go ahead. He said, run. So all of us took off running. My father watched us. Then my father took off, passed all of us up. And he's at the end of the block. And he's waiting for us to get there. He said, your father run fast. I said, I know. So this man knew when my father was chasing him, you know, the guy was running for his life. Daddy came back. He hadn't caught him. He said, he ain't coming back in no more. And the man next door, older couple, they said, well, we know from now on, if there's any problems, we're coming to you, Mr. Lloyd. And they said, because we feel safe with you. We understood what that feeling was like, because we knew my father would take care of anybody.
Right.
And, you know, I write about how he had broke his foot walking our dog. Leona and I had to give up our dogs to get an apartment. So we gave him to our father. You know, I had a German Shepherd. I had a poodle. He's walking the dog down the alley. He's the dog. The shepherd sees a cat. He takes off. My father gets dragged with the leash because his dog is charged. That so he breaks that cast down there. He has to have a cast on his leg. So we got him a lazy boy, and he wanted it out on the yard. He lived on a corner lot, and he's sitting there with the two dogs. One on each side, and that was what my father did. He didn't like, he never took a vacation. This was a forced vacation. And the kind of young guys came down the street, and they said, oh, man, you better not be out here when we come by again. And they kept going. My father hobbled into the house, got his shotgun, came back out, sat down, put that thing across his lap. My mother said, oh, she called us. We come running over there. She said, your daddy going to kill somebody. Your daddy going to kill somebody. I said, well, what? And we went out there and talked to our father. He said, nobody tells me to go inside of my house.
Mm.
I live here. He said, no one tells me. He said, what I can and cannot do at my house. In other words, he wasn't going to live scared.
Mm.
He'd rather die than live scared.
Wow.
And he said, no one tells me. And he sat out there with that gun till it got dark. He did this for a week. They didn't come back. If they did, they looked out there and saw that man sitting there with that shotgun. My father was like, I'm not going to be told how to live in my own house.
Wow.
No. So, you know, these are lessons that we learn. When you stand up for something that you believe in and you don't let fear take over, you know, and you in different positions, in different spectrums of your life, these are lessons we learned as young girls watching
right.
him. And, you know, my mother would cower. She's scared because she said, your daddy goes back. Daddy said, I'm not going anywhere. You know, he had been through racism. He had been basically when he was in the service, and I talk about this, and he passed the exam to be an officer. But because of the racist situation back then, you could only eat with officers, but the officers were black and white. You can't eat with the white officers.
Hmm.
There were no other black officers. So what are you going to eat by yourself?
Wow.
And then he, the sleeping quarters, same thing. He would have been isolated. And that would have been inhumane. And I talk about how that's used in a punishment way, even in today's penal system.
Right.
But, you know, I said, my father turned it down. He said he wanted to be with his men. And he couldn't be isolated by himself.
Right.
Now, that's racism dictating, you know, what you can and cannot do. Now, there may have been some men that decided to go along with that, but my father said, no, I'm not, I want to be with my men. And I talk about how many men he was over when they went overseas and all this. My father was a very smart man. He's one of the smartest men I've ever known.
Right.
And, you know, he loved reading. And, you know, and we, when he saw us reading the book on Malcolm X our first year in college, he said, why are you reading that? That's it. That's one of my books, Sociology, Daddy. I knew him. Hmm. I said, you know this man? You know this man? He said, they call him Detroit Red. I said, and I always sat there listening, fascinated, listening to the story from my father, who rarely talked.
Right.
If he said something, you better listen, because it's going to be a gem.
Sure.
And when he did say something, you know, he just didn't waste words. And he started telling us this story. And then it went from there to the Purple Gang. He was talking about all of the stuff that was happening back then. And my mother said, yeah, your father knew all about that stuff.
Hmm.
And so that was the first time we'd heard. So anytime we put the book down, the other and I both had a book each. If we put one book down, you're doing some other kind of homework. My father would go to the book that's laying there, you know, and he continued to read. So it was almost like a race, you know, who's going to finish the book first?
Right.
Me and the owner or Daddy. Daddy finished it first.
Yeah. Let me switch gears for a minute because there's a excuse me. I recall the episode regarding your hair when you were coming up. And
I didn't hear you.
Something with your hair.
Oh, yeah, okay.
If you talk about that a little bit, because I know that that was a point of contention and some things that, I guess, some stresses that you had to deal with regarding your hair when you were coming up.
Right. I worked at Wayne State as, you know, as an office assistant. And it was during those times that, you know, Rap Brown, Angela Davis, all mm-hmm. Sophie Carmichael, all of those were the leaders of the black movement at that time. Civil rights had done what it could do. But these were the young folks coming up saying, but you didn't go far enough.
Hmm.
And we want it now. We don't want to be waiting, you know, no pie in the sky, no turning cheek. And so this was the group. This was the group I was listening to.
Okay.
And it made a lot of sense to me. Okay. I mean, both groups made sense. And the first group had their chance to do what they were going to do. But now this group is taking it a step further. So I was very influenced by Angela Davis, all of the Nikki Giovanni. I used to do the poetry thing in college. Yeah. I mean, I was into all of it.
Okay.
The last poets, the whole thing. And so I knew that changing my hairstyle was like an expression of black love. It's who you are and the appreciation of who you are.
Sure.
Okay. That's what it symbolized to me.
Right.
And to what the movement meant. Okay. Empowerment, self-empowerment. So when I changed my hairstyle, Leona changed her hairstyle. And it was funny, I didn't even write about this, but I went over to my mother's house, woke him up in the middle of the night, and said, hey, we just come by to say hi and show my new hairdo. And my mother said, oh, Lord, she hit my father. Hey, wake up. Wake up, look at the kids. Look at the kids. They all look at their hair. And so my father woke up, and he said, beautiful, beautiful. My mother said, I don't like it. She said, I love it. So, you know, I had a split house.
We
had a split house. And I started laughing at my mother. And I said, well, Mama, this is the way it's going to be. And my father said, it's beautiful. And he was, I mean, you're talking about a man who every week got the Black Panther pick. I mean, so you are talking about a progressive thinking person. Okay?
Sure, absolutely.
And my mother wore on the safety side. She grew up where the Klan was going around it. And she's hiding under beds as a little girl. And her mother's house was burnt down. Her brother's school that he built for kids, he graduated from Yale. It was burnt down. So she has that background. And so she's more fearful. My father's not. And so we took that not being fearful with us.
Right, exactly.
And so we changed it. I just didn't expect when I went to work, you know, I work with white women. And the oldest one was, you know, the supervisor. And she, they just looked at me. Oh, yeah, you have a different interview. I said, yep. And I was smiling. And they were quiet. Now, they talked about me when I wasn't there. And when the head of the art department, the dean, walked in, and he looked at me, and he said, he got to his door and said, turned around and said, new hairdo? I said, yes. He said, I like it. I said, good. And I smiled. And he's a progressive thing and like that. He walked into his office. And so 2 or 3 days later, the lady who's over all of us, she walks quietly up there to me and says, Leanya, you know, we were just thinking, you know, your new hairdo and everything. And I said, yes. And so she said, well, we kind of like the way you used to wear it before, you know, straight with the curls and stuff. And I said, uh-huh. And she said, well, we just wanted you, you know, to know, because we really like that hairdo. I said, well, that's too bad, because I like this one. And you know what? I'm going to be wearing this for a long time, probably for the rest of my life. And she looked at me, turned red in the face, and walked back to her desk. And I looked at her, and the other two girls were looking, because they were like nodding their heads at first with her in agreement. And then when I said what I said, they everybody quiet. Nobody was going to tell me though how to wear my hair. Okay, and when a Black Panther guy walked in, he's selling Black Panther papers on campus. Mm-hmm. He walked into, we were in a glass structure, so you could see it. But he saw my little black face sitting up in the front typing. And he walks in. He said, hey, sister. I said, hello. And so then he said, Black Panther paper. I said, I already get it. My daddy gets it. So then he looked at them and said, Black Panther paper. They were scared to death. And no. And there's no solicitation. And so he looked, he said, who in there? I said, oh, that's the boss. He's the one over there at the curtain. He said, can I go in there and ask him? And she said, no, you cannot go in there. He looked at me. He walked right through that door. He went in there. He said, Black Panther paper. I said, how much? He gave him the money. And he came out. He said, he bought a paper. Now, y'all want to buy a paper? I laughed. And they were petrified. But the bottom line is that was a sign of racism right there. You're not asking me anything about why did I change this. Just that what you like.
Right.
You know.
Control.
What that means to you.
Right. Trying to control you.
Right. Exactly. When I was taking a persuasion speech class, and there was one other black guy in class, and it was a Southern man who was our teacher. And I was getting ready to do the final exam speech.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, some black, I said, what are you gonna speak on? I said, Black Power. He said, are you nuts? He said, we had a man from the South. And he still got his accent. Are you going to get him? I said, yep. And he said, well, good luck, because you're braver than me. And I got up there, big afro and all. You know, boots, mini skirt, whole thing, and said, Black Power. And I had my hand in there, and I said it 3 times, and I raised my fist 3 times, and silence went across the room.
Mm.
I said, what comes to your mind when I say that to you? Are you scared? Fear set into your heart?
Mm.
I said, and I went on to explain what it meant. When I finished, and I said, and I did that same thing at the end, I said, the next time you hear it, now you know what it really means.
Hmm.
So everybody has to grade you. Everybody has to grade you. All the grades are collected and they're handed to you. And the teachers is on top. I got straight A's.
Hmm.
And that man said, wow. He said, you convinced this whole class that Black Power was the right thing to be on the side of. I said, that was the job, the place of speech. You know, the power of speech is very, very powerful. And I learned that. But I wasn't afraid. And I got that from my father. I wasn't afraid to be who I was. And if I want to wear it curly, I wear it curly. If I want to wear it, but I make that decision.
Right.
Nobody else makes it. You know, I make that decision. And, you know, the fact that they couldn't understand that, it didn't matter to me. Me and the head lady. I didn't hear you.
No, I said it sounds like there's some extremely powerful lessons in your book.
bright. I want it to be, because there are young people out there. When I talk about the protest I was in and how we lined up and how that they came in with the bayonets and all this, and I'm looking, and it's one-on-one against each one of us. And,
right.
And, with the, and I said, did it scare me? Yeah, it scared me. I was only 19. But we were fighting for this lady who had lost her job.
Mm.
And she didn't know who else to go to. She had 3 kids.
Wow.
And it's like, they said, who can help? They said, go to those black students. She said, their union. They have a black student union. And so when they asked to speak to the administration about her job, about being fired, and wrongfully, they said they wouldn't have an audience with it. So they said that we have to make them hear us. And the only way they'd make them hear us is through the pocketbook. He said, there. And we're shutting the cafeteria down.
Mm.
So, you know, we planned it. Now, I wasn't an officer, but I'm right there. I'm one of the soldiers. And so I go in, and my sister lived way off campus. I lived on campus. And so I was telling them what I was getting ready to do. So, and Kent State had already happened. So we lined up. And we would just tell people, you don't want to eat here. These people are prejudiced. They fired a lady with 3 kids, and unjustifiably. Her 90 days was almost finished, and they did it on purpose so she'd get no benefits. People would just put the trays down. They're thinking like, hey, there's some more places to eat on campus. We ain't got to eat here. We ain't got to get involved in this. So no one, all the black cooks were, you know, they're back there ready to serve. They're looking there, and they're smiling because they know their friend is gone.
Hmm.
And they see nobody is coming up to get none of the food they've cooked. And they ended up closing down the shutter. You know, we had successfully closed it down. Then they got on their walkie-talkies, and they were told to leave. So they left, okay? And just like they came, all of a sudden when they came and we heard all this noise and we looked down the hall and saw these guys coming with these bayonets and, you know, helmets and all this, and I'm like, now what? And so now they're leaving. And the, you know, and I remember talking to one guy and I kept saying, this is why we're here. This is that. He looked at me and he said, ma'am, I can't talk to you. I said, that's fine. I can do the talking for the both of us. Hmm. And I kept on going. And so when I look and I see the Black Lives Matter group, when I see them all trying to talk to officers, I remember. And what that's like.
Right.
And, you know, the difference is that they got, you know, the smoke bombs thrown at them, et cetera. But then you had officers that were black that were saying, wait a minute, mm-hmm. wait a minute. You know, some of them were saying, let's talk to them. Let's talk to them.
Right.
So, you know, they had at least a little fighting chance. And but I could understand because it was the power of their voice.
Sure.
That was very, very powerful. And I posted pictures on Facebook. It was going on all around the country for George Floyd, all around the country. And people were walking in protest. Okay, people were walking in protest. And it wasn't just black people, it was white people, it was all kinds of people walking in protest. He was not treated like a human.
Hmm.
So the bottom line was that as a kid in college, you know, and experiencing these things, I write about it because I know, you know, this is history repeating itself.
Right.
You know, like we fought for that lady. They ended up having a meeting with us because we were ready to come back the next day. We're going to do this every day until we got a meeting. They got word to us immediately and said we would meet with you.
Well, my friends, we've come to the end of the show, and we hope you have enjoyed the journey. Reach out to me on Instagram at Bobby Ray Ivory Jr., as well as Facebook, Bobby Ray Ivory Jr. on Facebook. Thank you so much for joining me. Have an absolutely fantastic day. And you know, I mean that. Be well, my friends, and ciao for now.
Many counted us out. They said we couldn't do it. Now, millions of listeners later, we're the hottest independent network in the world. Bashani Radio app. Download free in the App Store for iPhone and Android. Or listen online at BashaniRadio.com. You suckers. Kaboom! Kaboom in your face.